Yeah, there we go. Let's grab a seat. Good afternoon. Hey, Scott. Good afternoon. So, this is the third time we've had what we call Minds and Machines, which is talking about GE and analytics, the industrial internet. We had about 200 customers here this morning, so we had, you know, really a chance to demonstrate how quickly this is being adopted and some of the opportunities for future growth. What I'm gonna do today is just kind of start us off and then turn it over to the rest of the team. We've got a lot of the core service leaders in GE here today, Dan Heinzelman, some of the people that are actually building out the industrial internet, so we've got a nice array. So just to get started with just some top-of-the-house items, I think the things we talked about as we stood here in at the beginning of 2014, still on track. We still feel good about the framework for the year, on track for that. We've done a lot of portfolio stuff this year in terms of acquiring Alstom, spinning out Synchrony, selling the appliance business. We've invested in restructuring. You know, we've now put $4 billion into restructuring. We're seeing the benefits in SG&A and throughout the company, so those investments are paying off. We actually had restructuring in excess of gains this year, so that's provided headwind, but that's gonna provide tailwind going forward. And then, grew the dividend, and Synchrony will allow us to retire shares when we spin that out next year. What we talked about at EPG is it's a different company. Better portfolio, strong initiatives, competitively advantaged initiatives in technology, strong global position, way ahead on analytics, which I think you'll get a sense for today, and really driving the culture of simplification inside the company. From a portfolio standpoint, we're right on track to getting 75/25 by 2016 with Alstom and all the things we've done. We've been aggressive around the portfolio for a while now, both in terms of divestitures and acquisitions. We like the way the company is positioned today. Alstom, we think, is a good complementary, very attractive financial investment for our investors. Synchrony, we think, is off to a good start. It's gonna be a capital-efficient way to return cash back to investors by way of a buyback and reduce our financial services earnings. And appliances is a long-expected move in that space, and we think at an attractive position. What we talk about inside the company, and I think you'll get a great sense for it today, is that our infrastructure businesses really use what I would consider to be core to the company. When I look at what's core to GE, it's really technology that we push across the company in the global research centers and the work we do. It's the immense emerging market footprint that we have inside the company through our global growth organization, John Rice. It's the investments we've made in analytics that we're gonna talk about today, and it's this leaner structure, competitive structure, and culture that we think is rippling through the company. And that's all gonna add up to you in terms of organic growth that's better than our peers. We're on track to 17% margins by 2016, 17% returns, and consistent earnings growth. So while we're changing the portfolio, EPS is gonna be greater in 14 than 13. Our EPS in 2015 is gonna be greater than 14. Our EPS in 2016 is gonna be greater than 15. We're gonna grow EPS every year through this cycle while we're mixing the portfolio in a different way. So that's really the company. Our technology advantage versus our competitors, direct competitors, is stronger today than any day I can remember since I've run GE. I would say our investment in technology has kind of leveled off. As I've said in the past, we upped it in 2008, 2009 to really get ready for the bolus of new aircraft engines that we had coming in. That's now crested, so we feel good about our R&D productivity. But if you look at, we're the only one that has a Tier 4 locomotive. That is an awesome position to be in. Our LEAP win rate is huge. Our ability to gain market share now in the healthcare services market, DI market, is great. We're innovating in the H-turbine, so we've got a backlog building of the H-turbine, which we're well-timed on there. So our technology advantages, I think, versus our direct competitors, have never been greater than they are today. Technology is not just about driving new products, it's also about hitting new cost points. And so you're gonna hear today from Jamie Miller and others a little bit about how we're feeding information back to our development of products, getting new jet engines on faster learning curves, down the cycle faster, and using data and analytics to drive better productivity in the installed base. One of the big paydays of analytics, I think, in services is gonna be higher margins, better productivity, better analytics is gonna drive a lower cost structure. So, one part of innovation is the new products. The other part is really driving cost and productivity in a very accelerated way. We like our global footprint. You know, a lot, you can pick up the paper and read a lot about growth markets, but we have a very diversified portfolio of growth markets. Our growth market orders will be up double digits in 2014. We see continued diversity and strength around this. We have a, I would say, a very strong competitive advantage, again, versus our direct peers. And the way we've built out our global markets, we're extremely local, we're the first mover, we're diversified, we have local capability, and we're really able to connect the dots of GE and these growth markets between the breadth of the company, the brand and reputation. So we continue to see good diversified strength in our growth markets, and we think that's gonna continue into the future. Simplification is something I've talked to you guys about two or three times in the past. We really are driving it hard inside the company, and it's what I would call a multifaceted cultural change inside GE. It starts with structure. You know, people around the big companies for years have said, "Let's do more with less." I think one element of simplification is actually doing less, but doing it better with a lot less structure. So we're on our way to 12% SG&A as a percentage of revenue, a much leaner company, fewer P&Ls, fewer ERPs, a real strength, putting everything on the clock, so speed and cycle time. We've been doing lean for 20 years, but really even accelerating the pace at which we're driving cycle times inside the company, NPI productivity. We're just seeing some of our FastWorks tool really being able to generate good in-process productivity inside the company. Matching that with commercial intensity so that you really are out in the marketplace positioned to win. I think the key to restructuring big industrial companies is not to do things in isolation, but to link big initiatives to winning in the marketplace, and that's what we've done with simplification. So at the same time, we're taking structural costs out. We're actually becoming faster and more nimble in front of the customers and achieving our own digital entitlement, our own power of one, really digitizing the company as a way to drive cost and speed and margins inside the company. So when I talk in front of the GE team about what simplification means inside the company, it's these four things really nested together. And you can see it in our corporate costs, our SG&A coming down, our ERP consolidation, shared services. So we're on track to really hit our SG&A goals. 2014 will be another good year. We've got well positioned for 2015 with projects, and we've invested a lot in restructuring, and we think this is gonna continue to pay benefits. So that really is the company in terms of the big initiatives. Just a quick update before we dive deep now into the industrial internet. And so a couple things. I'll just try to lay the groundwork because, you know, we're beginning on this. There's things we know, there's things we don't know, there's things we think, there's some mistakes we'll make, and we'll learn, and things like that as this goes on. But in the end, markets are gonna go through transition. We grew up where physics dictated the performance of our products. Today, physics and analytics are dictating the performance of all of our products. This is just true. This is just a fact. It's just happening. I think we've recognized this. We're on it. We see it. And from your standpoint, what that really means is that this is gonna be you, people that own GE know the power of our installed base and the power of our service franchise. So if I said, what's the beginning level from an investor standpoint is, this is gonna be the next evolution of GE services, which are quite valuable to our investors. Our customers, if you sat here this morning, you got a sense that our customers know what they're doing. Our customers want to see this happen because they think it can make them more money. So being able to monetize outcomes through analytics is really something that our customers are asking for and demanding. We are exceptionally well positioned to lead because we bring machines, enabling technology, and we're adding data. So you can't win in this ultimately unless you have all three. We kind of own and dominate the first two, and we're building the third, so that's key. And you're gonna be able to eat it, you're gonna be able to see it in terms of taking this service earnings that you've known how to model and you appreciate. And our goal is that investors see this first and foremost by increasing the earnings growth rate of our services franchise. And you'll see throughout the presentation how we plan to do that. In addition, we think it's actually gonna feed back and help us build a bigger barrier around our product technology. And in addition, we have two or three ideas on things that might become industry standards that maybe can even increase and generate new businesses inside GE, but we're really not counting on that when I stand here today. We're investing, but we're not yet, you know, counting on that, and that's how you should think about the industrial internet. So you've been following GE for years. You know the value of our service franchise. We went from kind of a break-fix model to a CSA model. Analytics are kind of the next evolution of services change. This is a big, valuable franchise for the company. And on the customer side, when we describe the industrial internet, we always talk about the Power of One. Social media is all about connecting hundreds of millions of people together. The industrial internet is about driving small changes in the industrial setting using better diagnostic, better analytical and informational tools. So if you just look, for instance, at the GE installed base of jet engines, given how big we are, a 1% change in fuel generates $2 to $3 billion for our airline customers. So, you know, I could tell you one story after another, and our team's going to go through this today. So this is the next, think about this as the next iteration in the transformation of a very valuable franchise that you've learned to appreciate in GE for a long time. Here are the three things it takes to be good at the industrial internet. Machines, valuable machines. So we have big backlog, big CSA backlogs of installed base, and we tend to have, in many of our industries, we have a money-making asset to our customers. So if you're an airline, you know how to value a jet engine. If you're a railroad, you know how to value a locomotive. If you're a hospital, you know the value that your radiology department can add. You add to that enabling technology. So these are things like sensors, controls, robotics. These are all the things we do at the Global Research Center. So the first two, you just kind of say check, check. GE is massive on the first one. We're a leader on the second one. And then you have to add to that the capability around data and analytics. So we have invested in talent on a horizontal basis. So, you know, we've been able to do this while taking our SG&A down. So simplification, this is a, let's say, a simplification dividend for our investors of the ability to fund this while still taking the overall cost down inside the company. We're building it out. We're leveraging our existing CSAs. And we've launched today a system called Predix. One of the announcements we made today is we're going to open up Predix beyond just the GE installed base. So we basically are going to say to our customers, look, you can do our assets on this, but we're going to let you do other people's assets. We're going to let you write your own applications. And so machine enabling analytics, that's what makes the industrial internet really work. And we think we're in a great position to lead on all three. And again, how do you monetize it from a company standpoint, financial standpoint, investor standpoint? I would say in phase one, where we are today, we think about enhancing the service model. So you're going to hear from our service leaders today who are really presenting this today, you're going to hear new innovation. And those innovations are going to be called asset optimization, operations optimization. You're going to see real examples with real customers on innovations that are taking place there. You're also going to see productivity. Out of the box, some of the most significant benefits of the industrial internet for investors is going to come through higher margins on our CSAs and higher margins on our service contracts and our ongoing service business. And you're going to hear great stories of that today. Then we're going to generate more revenue in terms of having more dollars per CSA, having incremental service revenues come in through the asset we call asset performance management. And we're going to do enterprise-type systems as well. So when we do a movement planner to a railroad is essentially their ERP system inside the railroad. So those are the different ways that we're going to monetize it. And then when you go to our repair shops, these are now going to be data-driven repairs. So we used to do repairs based on a calendar cycle. Now you can do all your repairs really for cause. You really now have the ability to look across your entire installed base, and you can get tremendous productivity out of your installed base. We did this as a make versus a buy, right? So we've taken a few small equity stakes in software companies, but I don't view this really as an acquisition play. I view this as an internal capability play as we go forward. We've launched new offerings. You'll hear the word predictivity. Predictivity is the brand we use to brand these assets. We've leveraged the CSA relationships, frequently in a CSA relationship, we'll already have some kind of operating bonus system with our customers. So, you know, when we launch an initiative like this, we don't have to go in and resell it to our customer base. We have these already built-in transactional engines called CSAs inside the company. And we have engaged, because we're a first mover, if you sat here today, we're with Intel and Cisco and all the other people in the ecosystem. There's a real first mover advantage here in terms of building out the ecosystem. So here's how these are kind of the stories you're gonna hear from our service leaders today in terms of how it goes. And I guess, you know, you're gonna get a sense today. I think, you know, you've seen, as we presented, you've seen these as ideas. This is real. This is happening. Customers, you know, if you're here this morning, you heard a ton of customers talking about. I just picked the rail example because these things are all happening today. And these range from advanced controls, which is gonna help you get fuel performance, sensor and analytics, which are gonna allow you to do predictive repairs. So you start repairing stuff before it needs to take place. Service robotics allows you to go to a field where these are all parked and do remote monitoring on wheels as you go through. Automated decisioning is really what's called the movement planner, allowing you to decide which locomotives go and which locomotives stay. And we kind of put this, you know, in the guise of kind of no unplanned downtime. I remember one of my previous jobs, I was responsible for the appliance service business during the rotary compressor fiasco. Cost per repair on a compressor was $200 if you showed up before it broke, and it was $500 if you showed up after it broke. So just the ability to have the prognostics around repair is awesomely important. And so that's how you think of this is real. This is happening. You're gonna hear great stories today. I would say, you know, we've been doing this now for 4 or 5 years. One of the things that I learned, having spent more time with Bill and the people in COE is how much better we can be at our own IT. You know, having gone through this, we now have turned the mirrors on ourselves to say what's possible in the GE 1%. And I would say the GE leaders, we weren't as good at managing our own IT as we could have been or should have been. But you'll hear from Jamie today what the value of our own internal information technology from a productivity standpoint and some of the goals and programs we have to drive margins and productivity enhancement inside the company. So this is our 1%. And Jamie Miller, who's our CIO, is gonna tell you how we're gonna get our own 1% out of this. And then finally, value creation. How do you think about value creation in this world? $180 billion backlog, $45 billion roughly of revenue, roughly 30% margins today. I would say historically, let's say over the last 6 years, we've grown organically 5%. We've grown margins 50 basis points a year. And we've been more limited by how fast our installed base grew. You know, my goal for the team and for all of you is to increase the growth rate, organic growth rate of our service business, increase the rate of margin expansion for our service business. So our goal is to have our services earnings grow faster because of this investment. And that's gonna come from dollars per installed base. Well, you're gonna hear the team talk about productivity solution sales, which are about $1 billion right now. We expect to be $4 billion-$5 billion in the next few years. Those aren't all incremental. Some will be incremental. Some will be embedded in CSAs and things like that. Big-time services productivity. Big-time services productivity. So from an investor standpoint, I would say the way you underwrite this is by saying services has been a very reliable earnings grow over time. If we can make that faster, that is something you can see, you can feel, you can invest in. You do it both from productivity and from an organic growth standpoint. So very, you know, you don't have to take huge leaps of faith to see those happening. And then I'd say you're gonna own a ticket to things that could be even bigger in the future. If Predix becomes a standard in the industrial operating system, that's a good thing for GE. If our feedback, because we know more about analytics, is gonna, you know, create a bigger barrier around our products, higher product market share, that's a good thing. So there's things beyond just growing our service business faster that are long-term benefits for our investors as well. But I would underwrite these as what is the most straightforward thing to do in GE land? It's make our service franchise even more valuable. And so that's what you're gonna hear today. So today we've got Dan Heinzelman, who's Vice Chairman. He's gonna speak next and talk about how we run services as an enterprise advantage inside the company. Then you're gonna hear from Bill Rue and Kate Johnson. They really have joined GE recently, and they're gonna build out the industrial internet in terms of what we do. Then you're gonna hear the business examples of how we're making it real, and then Jamie's gonna talk about what we're doing on our own internal information technology. So with that, let me turn it over to Dan Heinzmann.
Thanks, Jeff. So as you know, we've been at this services game for a while, and we've built a really nice set of businesses here. You know, not only have we been able to grow the business, we've been able to expand our margins at the same time, and on top of that, grow the backlog. You know, and I think if you look at why we've been successful, we've got a lot of things working in our favor. You know, we've got a great installed base. We have tremendous technology that is developed either at the GRC or at one of the businesses that we're able to leverage around the system. You know, the CSA model. The CSA model gives us a view of work and a view of how a longer-term timeframe to think about how we can create value for customers. And, you know, we built out a global business at the same time. So, you know, the addition of software, the addition of much more operational data from how the fleet is working, is really opening up a whole new space for us to think about creating value for customers. And, you know, our imperative is it starts with the customer. You know, if we can't create more value for them throughout the life of their asset, they're not gonna entrust us with this work and this relationship. And if we do a good job with that, it's very virtuous, right? It helps us to sell more equipment because they know they can rely on us to improve their equipment and improve the way that they use that equipment throughout their life. So, you know, that works for them. It gives us the ability to look at how we manage that relationship and that outcome, and with an expanded set of ideas around how to manage the costs or the way that we deliver that outcome. So, you know, we've got a wonderful system here, and we are very fortunate to have businesses that are capable of working together and sharing ideas and learning from each other. It's really helped us to accelerate learnings in many ways. You know, and it starts with our service council. You know, we've been doing this service council since the late 90s, and, you know, we've learned a lot through the years. I'd say, you know, we started with these things that are hardware and domain-oriented. We've had teams working on these concepts, some of them for, you know, well over a decade. And in many cases, we've trained our services leaders how to operate and how to run their businesses by being part of this council. Now, so we have leadership from across the company that participates. Most recently, we've aligned our work around 9 themes that we have in common, themes where we all stand to gain or benefit by advancing the technology or advancing the concepts and learning from each other. You know, the hardware's been around for a long time. The domain, the analytics and the software is newer for us. And, you know, what we found was the data is now extraordinarily important. We've always had a lot of data. Now we have a real lot of data, and we're learning much more around how to drive outcomes through using that data to understand our equipment at a deeper level. You know, and I'd also say we've been really good at taking technology from one place and bringing it to another. You know, healthcare develops technology for analyzing people, and we turn that same technology around for analyzing or examining industrial equipment, and it's really helping us to manage risk and to manage cost in the way that we do our maintenance. Aviation always been on the leading edge in repair technology development. Today, that technology is being used in pretty much every one of our businesses. And in fact, we collaborate and share resources around how we develop the next level of technology there. And then globalization. You know, power and water was clearly the first to be globalized, and we've taken advantage of that in each of our businesses as we've started to think about how we're going to be more local in the way we do this around the world. So we've got a great recipe here, and, you know, we've got a great set of technologies that we bring to the game, you know, and these are just 6 examples. Robotics, you saw a little bit this morning for those of you that were here around how robotics is really going to enable another level of risk mitigation as well as better insights into what's going on with our equipment out in the field. Sensing and control is critical, inspection technology, repair technology, and most recently, mobile tools. You know, we're trying to take advantage of the tools that are the technologies that are available, and Jamie's going to talk a little bit more about this. But basically, we can arm the people that are on the point out in the field with more information today and more guidance around how they do their jobs so that we have a better and more consistent outcome and a more efficient outcome, get it done more efficiently as we execute our jobs. You know, and it all kind of comes back to the CSA for us. You know, I can tell you in the beginning, you know, back in the very, when we started focusing on services, CSAs were not easy to sell. CSAs were a leap of faith. We've really, really deepened our relationships with customers through the years as we've got on their side, as we've been able to bring value to them, you know, in the form of fuel efficiency and in the form of, you know, new technology. The upgrades that we sell, the upgrades that we bring to customers to improve their equipment, our ability to deliver that comes from the deep understanding that we've gained on how they use their equipment more efficiently or how they use it actually over time. For us, you know, this allows us to do it more cost effectively. We've learned a lot about how to really dial in the amount of cost or the amount of work scope required to fulfill the mission of the equipment, and the analytical tools and the ability to kind of get it done out in the field is also, you know, light years ahead of where it used to be. Material productivity is critical. Now, this little picture here, you know, that we have now a line of sight to actually putting gauging or putting sensors on the parts that are going to teach us even at a deeper level what is going on with these parts throughout their life or as they're used, giving us insight into how they wear out, when they wear out, and quite frankly, reducing the risk that things can go wrong. You know, so we've got these service businesses today. Each of them, in their own kind of way, has a different dynamic, a different industry, but they do have many things in common that we work together. You know, these are six great businesses. Each of them has found or are finding ways to work with their customers to achieve outcomes that in the past we never even talked about with them. And you're going to hear from each, you're going to hear from, I think, five of these businesses here today. And, you know, they're going to give you some examples around how they are working with customers in new and different ways going forward. So we're going to start with Bill and Kate, as Jeff mentioned. Then we're going to get into power and water through transportation and finish it up with Jamie. She talks a little bit about how we're working on that 1% for us, turning these tools into our own operations to drive improvement. You know, so next I'm going to bring Bill up here. You know, Bill and Kate, just for those of you that aren't familiar with them, they've come into our company. They are really enabling for us this marriage of hardware, the equipment, with this new world, this next chapter, and how we're going to deliver value. So, Bill, you're up next. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. So, you know, when we started this journey 3 years ago, there were these five distinct, seemingly disconnected trends that we saw in the marketplace. And the reality is that these five trends are all part of this bigger idea of an industrial internet, and they come together to transform industrial businesses in the same way we've seen similar trends in the consumer world begin to transform consumer businesses. Now, when you look at it, 4 years ago, nobody was writing anything about it. There were no numbers. What's really interesting now, we're seeing industry analysts begin to talk about this topic. You can see some of what Gartner's saying about it. One of the things we love is they've actually defined a market category called asset performance management. And this is the idea that that companies want more out of their assets, more out of their operations, and that there is a marketplace for tools, technology, and outcome-based solutions in this. And they're talking about a $300 billion opportunity. So we're starting to see people put together what is this opportunity, what's the size of the market. We've been working with folks like Accenture to figure out, well, what do customers want? I really love the right side of this page. This is recent survey data, which gets down to where does this fit in the priorities? They know that they got a lot of data. They know they want to put analytics. They know they want to get outcomes. If you go back 3 years, 4 years ago, they didn't even know what this meant to them. Now we're seeing them put this as a number one priority or in a top three priority. When we're seeing 70%-90% of the market beginning to prioritize this, we know in the next 5 years, there's going to be a shift where they're going to look for people to come bring them this technology. When we look at this, we're pretty excited that the customers have now come around from 4 years ago when we saw this connection and began to work on it to where we are today, and we're going to start to see them continue to buy these kind of solutions and demand them. We also did our own survey directly with our customers. We wanted to understand this idea of asset performance management. What did they think it is? What was important to them? We asked them the question, what are the most important areas that you had? You can see on the left-hand side of this chart, these top four areas were consistent whether we talked to healthcare providers, whether we talked to oil and gas customers, aviation customers. That gave us a lot of hope that this idea of this market would actually appear because all four of those are what Gartner calls APM. It wasn't these other things. It was the cornerstone of what they're looking for. I think you're going to see from our businesses, this is exactly the kinds of solutions they're delivering now every day out there. In addition, we asked them, how do you want to buy it? They are not looking to do it themselves. I think they don't feel they have the talent. They will work with system integrators because they believe they have to get some help. By and large, we think this will have much of what is the ERP market, where they're going to want something that's 80% baked. They're looking for the ability to tailor, not custom develop. That is a big trend. They do want to tailor it, and they do want to add their own value to it. When you look at the future and you think about a power plant, an oil field, a fleet, a factory, they're all going to kind of have this capability. What's interesting is across all of our industrials, they have many of the same attributes. They're talking about the idea that we're going to add intelligence into a piece of equipment. This idea of software-defined machines, that's the trend that's coming out. We're going to connect all of that, whether it's GE, non-GE, and then they want to be able to get insight onto that data. This is the generic model that we see across all the businesses we have out there. Now, when you think about what we've been doing and how we've been preparing ourselves over this period of time, what we realized when we saw that the model and the underpinnings was all based on the same things across the businesses, we realized that having a single platform as the enable for the industrial internet would allow us to go at a scale and speed that we couldn't do if we did everything custom from the bottom up. The cornerstone strategy for us was building the Predix platform, which is all the enabling capability to make machines smart, build industrial data lakes, put large quantities of analytics on it, and deliver really compelling user experiences. I'll talk about it more, but add in industrial cybersecurity at the same time. For us, this platform, which we announced today that we're not only going to use it internally, but we're taking to the market, is a cornerstone of our industrial internet strategy. Now, you're going to hear from the businesses, it's all about them. It is all about them building productivity solutions. What we've found is there's two kinds that customers want. There's the asset performance management one. Take a piece of equipment or a large piece of machinery and help me get more efficiency out of it or more productivity out of it. Essentially, that's what they're looking for the asset. The second kind of application we see here is an operational one. Now that I've got one single piece of equipment that I've enabled, you know what? I want to look at a whole process. I want to look at a whole system. I want to optimize my people. I want to optimize my processes in the context of that equipment. We see these two kinds of analytics-based applications at the center point of what customers are looking for. You're going to hear a lot about how our businesses are generating these today, because in the end, The one change we also see is the buying model is they want to buy insight and outcome. And so in the end, productivity delivers insights and outcome. That's the value. That's what they're going to pay for. Now, we also realized that we had to figure out how to develop on this at speed and scale. And so we have invested a lot into looking at what the best in class have done, the consumer internet giants, and created a process that uses a lot of the same technology and techniques, but adapted to more of an industrial base. And what that means is agile and extreme programming. It means the ability to use user-centered design and build compelling user interfaces. No longer building user interfaces built by engineers for rocket scientists, building interfaces that are at least as good or better as what you're going to see on the consumer side. Also, the idea of how we co-innovate with ourselves and businesses and our customers. And finally, we know you have to start and put industrial cybersecurity in from the start, and that's part of the process. If you look on the right-hand side, you can see you're going to hear about a lot of the things we've done in asset optimization and operations optimization. We've also done quite a number of analytics just to get productivity in our services. I want you to take a look at the numbers, and what's really, really critical to note here is this is not going to be like the ERP market, however, where you have one or two or three big solutions. What we're seeing is that there are going to be thousands and thousands of analytics bundled as apps, big analytics, small analytics, and it's going to look a lot more like what has come out of the smartphone market with a lot of apps and the ability to pick and choose and utilize those. So when you look at these, we think that while we've done these around our machines, the future is our customers want to do it themselves, and we're finding partners who want to do it on top of this as well and take those to market. And that's the way we think this will roll out over time. In addition, I think we had to find out, did people want to come do this? Because you have to have the talent. And over the last 2.5 years, we've created a center out in the Bay Area, had access to talent and as well as access to people who know innovation and business models that apply to this. We've hired, at this point, 1,000. We'll be about 1,200 by the end of this year. And we've coupled those with the 14,000 people we have globally building applications. And we're training them on top of the platform. We're training them on top of this new process. So we've been bringing in the talent from the areas that know how to do this and leveraging that in the company. And as a result, we think we have some real differentiators in the platform, in four deep core competencies applied into industrials. And you can see them there. Cybersecurity, user experience, data science, and how you do agile development and build these kind of apps at scale and speed. We've also created an ecosystem. I call attention to that box over there. That box is a Cisco router. It's part of their new FOG architecture. You can put that anywhere. Two things. That inside that box is Intel processors. Inside that box is Predix machine services. I can have that box out in an oil field, up on a pole. I can collect data, put analytics, and load them into that box and run them right there at that facility. And so we are starting to build products with our partners to take to market to enable this whole kind of ecosystem. I mentioned cybersecurity. IT cybersecurity is different than industrial cybersecurity. We've discovered this in the last 4 years. Data centers don't move. They're locked in buildings. PCs have a different set of issues than when you start talking about a piece of equipment. Think of a substation in your neighborhood. Think of a locomotive moving down a rail. Our environments are not clean. They're not in a locked building. So when you look at the kinds of environments we're in, we need to secure equipment. We need to secure against a different set of attacks that's usually around controllers. Last May, we announced acquiring an industrial cybersecurity company who focused on this. Some of the inventors of this who created the Achilles standard, used by four of the top six oil and gas companies in how they buy equipment, for example. 9 of 10 automation vendors use them. When you look at them, they created the certification assessment product process for industrials. They've also created the technology to protect equipment. And we launched today, or announced today, the Achilles Industrial Firewall, which is aimed at protecting equipment and allowing that to work within the existing IT cybersecurity infrastructure as well. So very much feel differentiated around what we're doing in cybersecurity. Finally, it's also, this is a team sport, and that's an example of a team coming together with something pretty compelling in the marketplace. So when we look at this, partners and alliances, investing in new companies, acquiring companies, creating the Industrial Internet Consortium so we can drive standards so all this will work together, this is part of our strategy. The important point to make is we've discovered and thought we needed Predix for ourselves, and it's a way for us to scale and do speed for our businesses. It's a way for us to take what we learn in aviation about how to do predictive maintenance and pop it right over into our power generation services. It's a way for us to get speed by using and reusing capability across the businesses. And that's why you saw those large numbers before of capability, because we have the ability to do that. What we've discovered is our customers started to say, not only do I want to get that outcome, I want to add value on it. And so we will be selling Predix in 2015 out to the market, machine services, data and analytics service, asset services. So the table is set. And I want to turn it over to my partner, Kate, who's going to talk to you now about how we take this forward. Thank you very much, Kate.
Thanks, Phil. Okay, so how do we commercialize this? How do we go fast? How do we maximize the benefit of everything that Bill and his team are building? Just harken back to the consumer internet, two quick lessons, right? Everything changes when it's digitized. Every business model turns on its head. And the second thing is, it goes lightning fast. So how do we maintain the lead that we have in terms of delivering value to our customers? We have to leverage what we've got, and we've got a lot. So in the industrial internet, 50 billion machines are going to come online. $1 trillion worth of machines are already under our care, right? Our service businesses are the caretakers of $1 trillion worth of locomotives, jet engines, power turbines, and various other assets. We have 10 million sensors deployed on those connected assets, throwing 50 million data elements through our door on a regular basis. Right? That's a lot. You take the 1,000 programmers and data scientists that Bill has, and you combine it with that ton of data, and what you have is mountains of data all of a sudden turned into insight and delivered through to our customers day after day after day through our service businesses. And as our customers begin to focus more and more on outcomes, outcomes like reliability, availability, productivity, efficiency, and of course the holy grail, no unplanned downtime, as they start to focus on those outcomes, we have to be able to go to market in that context. And it's different, right? Selling an outcome is different than selling machine and a traditional service contract. So instead of a CT scanner and some traditional maintenance, we're selling a low-dose, high-quality image. Everything you do to sell that is different, right? It's still the same equipment. It's still that traditional maintenance, but it's got a whole thread of analytics through it that help give information that maximize the performance of that asset. And that's where we really have to focus, because that's using what we've got, and it's leveraging our advantage in the marketplace. What we have to do is fine-tune our commercial skills to be able to take advantage of that. We're going to be selling to CIOs and CTOs now. We're going to have to work across P&Ls and architect solutions that leverage capabilities across businesses, and I mean from oil and gas to power and water, just as much as between all the P&Ls inside of oil and gas. And that's a little bit different. We have to choreograph our dance as we go to market, right? We also have to get used to selling things that don't necessarily exist today. We can co-create with our customers. This morning we had a customer on stage with us that recognized the need for low dose in the marketplace, knew that there was going to be regulatory pressure. She came to us, and through co-creation, we have an established product in the marketplace that's leading the industry in terms of dose management. That's partnering with customers. That's leveraging Bill's app factory, where we can take great ideas and get to actual product in record time using the design thinking process and agile development. All of these things are different. And of course, the ecosystems that we're creating are partnerships with Intel, with Cisco. These are partners who are going to help us go to market faster. And we're going to focus on building partnerships where those companies have skills that we need, partnerships with companies like Accenture, where they can add credibility in terms of systems integration in the areas that we don't necessarily have, but we bring all the domain expertise and the App Factory to bear so that we can use our analytics to drive value in record time. In order to get us up to speed, we've built a center of excellence. The people are here, already in place. We're aligned to the businesses. We have experts from around the industry, software selling experts and outcome sellers from consulting firms and the like, who are supporting our businesses and helping them focus on the difference in selling an outcome. Got to focus on those client needs, got to be great at targeting the outcome, and you have to be able to architect new solutions that leverage capabilities across the P&Ls. And we have a robust enablement toolkit so that we can both train the people who are here who have what it takes to be able to do this new kind of selling, as well as provide the tools to the people that we bring in from other places. Three routes to market, right? So inside of the traditional CSA, we have the ability to infuse analytics and deliver new outcomes. That's going to help us raise price as well as grow margin through productivity, right? An example, Reliability Max. Brian Palmer is going to come up here, and he's going to talk to you about all three of these products, but we used oil and gas as a framework because we're using all three routes to market, and we're trying to figure out how to accelerate those routes to market in his business. So Reliability Max, you've got an opportunity to remotely monitor LNG facility equipment, the health of that equipment, and basically, it's all about uptime, right? So we're selling uptime, which is different than just selling equipment plus maintenance. And there's an opportunity for performance. So if we guarantee a certain performance but we overdeliver, we have the opportunity to grow that. How do we sell that? SWAT team. We have people who know how to do it inside. We basically gather them together and swarm the deal. The next two columns are net new revenue streams for us, but also using our existing relationships and our analytics capability. The middle one, selling APM subscription services, great example. FieldVantage, the offering that we launched at Last Finds and Machines, provides remote monitoring diagnostic for wellheads in an oil field, right? Traditional method, you send a truck out with a field engineer to figure out whether or not the pump's working. Kind of old-fashioned, kind of not very automated. The new way is remotely you're understanding which wells are performing so that you can, if there's a problem, understand it early and then diagnose it and also send some prognostics in terms of if things aren't looking so good, you can dispatch the right field personnel at the right time. The great thing about this product and this type of offering, it's net new revenue, and we can go lightning speed. Hire software sellers, little ninjas that can come in here and help us do repeatable sales very, very quickly, land and expand methodology where we do a couple of wells for a customer, and if we perform, we get the rest of their wells. We already have a couple of these under our belt, and things are looking very good in terms of momentum. And then finally, the third category of product is the one that I was talking about before where we need that App Factory. It's enterprise-level deals where we're engaged with the C-suite, talking about breaking new ground together, and then working together to build the product, co-creation. It's about bringing in ecosystem partners like Accenture, where we just couldn't deliver it without them. They're going to take care of the ERP, SI, integration piece of it. We're going to focus like a laser on building analytics around the industrial pieces of the project, right? So three new streams, going fast across all of them. It's early days in terms of getting to scale, but we already have the feet on the street. We already have strategy to bring the right people in to augment to get to scale. And finally, in terms of commercialization, we have a traditional 5% run rate. What are analytics going to do to our business? Number one, we really think it can accelerate the growth of services. We're going to look at three main metrics in order to do that. The first is assets under management. I talked to you about $1 trillion worth of assets under management today. That's going to keep growing. That is our playground. If we are connected to the machine, we can continue to upsell services to that machine. We can make it more and more and more valuable all the time. As we deliver more outcomes, the platform gets richer and more valuable, enables us to sell more outcomes. So the first step is connection, and then it's all about the upsell. Watch out for that assets under management number. Second one is the productivity solutions. 40 applications already in the basket to take to market. We're going to continue to grow that. As we open up Predicts, you'll see the acceleration of productivity solutions explode because our customers will be innovating on the platform. We'll be innovating on the platform. There'll be cross-pollination, and you should see the rate of innovation increase. And then finally, the services backlog should continue to grow. In summary, it's about using existing relationships to go faster, using net new services based on analytics. It's about selling new offerings that leverage those analytics, but also bringing in the right commercial skills, outcome sellers, those solution architects that I talked about, and all the right product management and product marketing expertise. And finally, focusing like a laser on the ecosystem. It's going to be a new realm out there. Everybody wants a piece of this space. We have to pick our partners very carefully, but we have to pick them quickly because everything's going to change at lightning speed. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Paul McElhaney, CEO of PGS.
Great. Thanks, Kate. Good afternoon. Power and Water Services, a $12.5 billion business in 2013, which will grow in 2014. Strong backlog of $53 billion, which will also grow in 2014. And some interesting dynamics on the install base. So the number of units in the field has more than doubled since 2008, and we now have over 4,000 gas turbines in service. Sorry, can you go back one slide? Thank you. On the right-hand side, Dan Heinzelman talked about the key imperatives. I won't talk about all of these, but there's two of them that I would draw out. Grow dollars per install base. Jeff talked about how important that is in terms of future growth for the services businesses. We're pretty excited in Power and Water about the proposed alliance with Alstom. When that joins our family next year, that'll add 350 gigawatts of installed base to our installed base, which is a 35% increase to our installed base. That'll really help on our dollars per installed base. And then on expanding margins, you've heard a lot over the last couple of years about our AGP offering. Our focus is really to go beyond the current AGP offering and really to look at technology upgrades across a wide spectrum that can apply to all of the assets we have in the field. So you'll see some interesting products come to market that we think will expand our margins and help fuel the growth of this business for years to come. You will see, since I'm the first business up here, we've got four more business leaders that will come up and talk. Everyone will use a chart that looks something like this. So it'll talk about the challenges that the customers in our various industries are having to face on a daily basis. In the power space, whether it's fuel prices, fuel can account for up to 80% of the operating expenses of running a power plant, whether it's soft demand. So our European customers, no surprise that in the last couple of years, they've seen some real softness in demand and utilization of the assets in that region, or it's just the aging of the assets that they have in their portfolio. Our job on the services side is to partner with our customers. We've got to really understand their issues, understand their challenges, and then work with them to deliver meaningful outcomes that they can see in their income statement. This is about going beyond PowerPoint to actual results and outcomes that they can monetize and show in terms of their operational performance and their financial performance. So you'll see us in the power space align all of our productivity offerings around five key customer value levers. So these are the levers that can really influence the operational and financial performance of our customers. Output is just generating more electricity from the existing asset. Efficiency is doing that at less cost, less fuel. Availability is you have the unit available when you need it. Flexibility, how do you get on the grid quickly? How do you get off the grid quickly when it can maximize or minimize your exposure? And then the last one is reliability. This one's really all about what everyone today has talked about, which is no surprises, no unplanned downtime. We think collectively these levers are real drivers of customer performance, and our intention is to have a suite of products that partnering with these customers can show some real benefit in their income statement. So let me go a little bit deeper on just a couple of these hardware and software offerings that we have. The first one is the AGP, which you've heard a lot about. That's our redesigned hot gas path. That can show and drive significant benefit to customers. You know, on the output side, which is really key, you can get over 4% additional output when you install the AGP. I'll show you in a second what that means in terms of dollars for a customer. Our dry low NOx, our DLN, which is our emissions offering. So again, this is a redesigned combustion system in our turbine. That has the potential to reduce our reduce NOx by up to 40%, a really significant issue for customers, particularly in certain regions. And then our OpFlex solution. So this is model-based controls that were developed in the aviation space. And like Dan talked about, we're constantly looking at opportunities across these businesses to take real technology advances in one business, deploy them in another business to drive customer outcomes. In this case, we take OpFlex, and we can drive significant output benefits for customers. I would just, on the start time, so a typical start time for one of our turbines is about 45 minutes. We can use OpFlex and reduce that to 15 minutes. Just think about what that does for a customer that needs to get to the market quickly to optimize profitability, so a real significant benefit to some of our customers. So what does that mean in terms of benefit, and what does that mean in terms of monetization for a customer? On the left-hand side, this is our advanced gas pass product. So it shows output based on temperature. And what this shows is that across the temperature curve, output increases when you deploy the AGP on a 7F asset. The interesting thing is that when you take the hardware solution that is the AGP and you marry that with a software solution, which is the OpFlex, you really double down on the benefits our customers can realize. On the right-hand side, so AGP will drive per unit per year $1.7 million in terms of additional benefit for customers. When you take OpFlex and marry that hardware, software, then you can really get almost double the benefits. We've sold 125 of these AGPs with OpFlex combined. In fact, any customer that wants an AGP today is looking for the hardware and software. We don't sell the AGP on its own anymore. And then we've got 650,000 operating hours that validate these numbers. So this is really showing the improvement that we're expecting. We're seeing that in our customers' income statement. And finally, in our wind business, and we talked about this morning for those of you that were with us this morning. So the Wind Power Up product, which is a control-based software solution that optimizes the pitch of these wind turbines, optimizes the speed and the rating of the turbine. It can drive up to 5% additional output per turbine. And with this product, you can stay, if you're a customer, you can stay at the top of that power curve for longer, which is where all the profit is made. So 5% additional output can translate into significant profitability for some of our customers. And then we had a great customer. So E.ON, which is one of our great customers, they were on stage this morning validating that they have deployed this across their fleet. They have seen the 4% improvement that we talked about. So just to give you an idea, that improvement across their portfolio is the equivalent of adding 19 new turbines at no cost to their fleet. Really significant benefit. You know, we announced this product offering last year at Mines and Machines. It's only been a year, and we've already sold 1,400 of these, and the pipeline in terms of future orders is pretty positive. So thanks for your time, and I will introduce Jan De Witt.
Thank you. So look, our service portfolio in healthcare is a very important part of the overall healthcare portfolio. It comprises our services around asset maintenance, asset optimization, life sciences services, and then our healthcare IT business. We see good installed base dynamics in emerging markets. There's new infrastructure being put in place. Each socket is a service opportunity. In the mature markets, largely a replacement market, but customers want higher value services to help them drive outcomes. And then in our healthcare IT activity, healthcare is an industry that has been lagging in terms of applying information technology. And over the past decade, this industry has been catching up when it comes to IT, very much driven by either regulatory actions like the Accountable Care Act in the U.S., or the need for hospital systems to implement enterprise solutions. In terms of simpler service imperatives, you read about it every day in the newspaper, the move of healthcare from fee-for-service to value-based care, risk being passed on from payers to providers. Providers in this space need productivity. They are going after value, higher quality, lower cost. This industry is really starting to behave like an industry being industrialized. And that's an area where our service businesses really have the skills to drive that opportunity. And the opportunity in healthcare for productivity is huge. This is an industry that is sitting on 30% of waste. Some say it may be higher than that. Waste in the form of duplication of activities, waste in the form of unwarranted variation, or waste basically in non-productive processes. And each of you who've spent more than a day in a hospital in your life, you've probably lived it firsthand. So this is a situation where information technology can be a major game changer in allowing the industry to change and reach different levels of productivity. The good news today in healthcare is that the industry is sitting on a massive amount of data. Over the past decade, a lot of money has gone into digitization, turning paper into electronic medical records, turning analog X-ray film into digitized images in a PACS. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's only data. It's not insight yet, and it doesn't translate into new processes or better decisions yet. And if you would talk to a hospital CEO who just finished a very expensive hospital EMR implementation, they're going to be disappointed. They spend a lot of money and effort, and they have not gotten a lot of return for it yet. Even their doctors will tell them that they lost productivity because they're now inputting a lot of data, but they're not getting a lot out of it. Now, that's a shift and a trend that we saw coming a couple of years back. So we, at that point, pivoted our investments in healthcare IT away from competing in the basic hospital EMR space and started to put our money into developing those applications that would turn that data into actionable insight and that actionable insight into better processes and better decisions. And that's what today we call our integrated care software solutions portfolio, consisting of five big categories: enterprise imaging, care delivery management, population health management, financial management, and operations management. Five categories that map to the five key drivers that can unlock most of the value in healthcare. And each of these points to better quality and better productivity. Now, what we bring together in GE Healthcare is three distinctive capabilities. First, as GE Healthcare, we have a huge, deep, and broad installed base out there. We understand most of the devices that generate a lot of that digitized data. Second, in our healthcare IT business, we have the domain to understand analytics and workflows and create applications for that. And then third, I mean, you saw Bill Rue before, but Bill and the software COE and Predix, what they mean for a business like me is next generation software capabilities, cloud capabilities, analytics, data security, user experience, and mobility. And that allows us to play a key role in providing caregivers actionable insight where and when they need it. So let me take you through a couple of examples of great products that we have out there. The first one in imaging. Any care pathway in healthcare will start with a diagnostic. Okay? And the truth is that that diagnostic today is far from perfect, which means that we're all busy in healthcare,
yeah,
solving for sometimes not the right problem. Okay? That's a tremendous amount of waste. Okay? Now, imaging, yeah, and diagnostic imaging is really shifting. Okay? From yesterday, where it was about radiologists sitting in their dark room with a server in the basement, and on that server, yeah, they had their archiving software, they had their imaging applications, and they were working on the data that they had in their own silo, okay, which was the data of today. And they weren't collaborating with other radiologists, and for sure, for a given patient, they weren't looking at images that were taken a month back or that MR scan of 2 months, yeah, ago. Today, imaging is about enterprise collaboration. Okay? It's about cloud-based image exchange. It's about advanced visualization tools and analytics that assist radiologists in making the call. And it's about providing access to the full records of a patient, okay? Whether the patient was in this radiology department or in another one, whether it was today or whether it was a month ago. And so that allows really to bring more brains in a productive way to the diagnostic problem. Okay? Our Centricity 360 solution is a cloud-based image exchange solution that's out there in the market today, okay, driving great productivity and great quality for a number of customers. Okay? And again, these are customers that are healthcare networks or even, yeah, parts of countries that we enable, yeah, in their imaging and their diagnostic collaboration. Delivering great value under the form of cost reduction for our customers and creating a very, yeah, great service franchise for us, okay, imaging as a service. Second example is around operations management and specifically workforce productivity. Okay? When you talk productivity in healthcare, you have to talk about labor. Okay? It's 50%-60% of the cost in any hospital or any healthcare system. And today, hospitals do not do a good job in managing that asset productively. Okay? A lot of overtime on the one hand, a lot of underutilization on the other hand, and overtreatment. Okay? You have high-paying doctors sometimes doing the work of nurses. Okay? With our API workforce optimization solution, we use cloud-based analytics to start predicting the workloads, predicting for today, predicting for tomorrow, and not just the workload, but also the specific skill needs, and then matching that into the workforce planning. Okay? So at any time, you match real demand with real availability of the right skills at the right time. Again, delivering great productivity. Okay? The products that are out there in the market, labor productivity significantly up, and then dramatic reduction, yeah, in unplanned overtime wages for labor. Third example is about population health management. As risk is being passed on to providers, and providers take on that risk for whole populations, they realize that the way to do well there is to start to understand chronic disease, which makes up 70% of the cost in healthcare. Okay? Chronic disease management is all about identifying very early in the game those patients at risk for developing the chronic disease. Okay? It's about, in a population of 2 million, identifying who are those 200,000 people that are pre-diabetics, to give an example. Now, how do you do that, right? In a world where patients go to different hospitals, their data is scattered across multiple EMRs. Okay? Well, there's three capabilities you need to do well in population health management. Okay? The first one, yeah, is a data aggregation platform. Okay? A platform that allows you to unlock, liberate all that data that's locked up today in multiple EMRs, yeah, and other digital systems in hospitals. Second is analytics. Okay? Turn that data into insights on the risk profile, yeah, for a given patient. And then third is care management. Okay? Is turn that knowledge of the risk for a given patient into a customized care protocol, a care plan, and have your care nurse managers manage productively the care for that patient and make sure the patient really stays ahead, yeah, of its risk of developing a chronic disease. So three capabilities, okay, in our Caradigm joint venture, okay, joint venture between us and Microsoft, we have these capabilities. Okay, population health management is a very attractive emerging market. It's somewhat of the new gold rush, yeah, in the healthcare industry. They have, I mean, dozens and dozens of new companies popping up. Okay, there's very few, very, very few, that have the breadth and the holistic nature of the capabilities that we have in Caradigm. Okay, it's a joint venture that we created 2.5 years ago. Today, yeah, is running at an annual orders clip of about 100 million. So three examples that showed how we use software analytics into system optimization, process optimization. As some of the examples you saw before, we're using software analytics inside our asset optimization service business in two different ways. First one is performance monitoring. Yeah, most of our devices are remotely connected, are remotely monitored. That allows us not just to do remote fixes, but also allows us to go into predictive maintenance. Okay. In an MR scanner, where today we measure about 900 data points, we understand the fingerprint of an upcoming defect. Okay. We see it coming before it happens, and we can fix it before the machine ever goes down. Okay. That's pure productivity for our customers, and that's great quality for those patients sitting in that waiting room, not having to reschedule because the machine went down in an unplanned way. And then the second part is about workforce planning. Okay, we have, I mean, thousands of field engineers in the field. A lot of them spend 30-40% of their time driving to their next customer. Using analytics, using geolocation, we can do a much better job to match the right field engineer with the right skills and the right proximity to the problem to its clients. Okay, that drives productivity, drives the waste out of our own system, and again, results in a better fix faster for our customers. Okay, so all of these examples that I gave you are the same common denominator. Okay, data being turned into actionable insight into better process and better decisions, which for our customers means quality and cost down. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Kevin from our aviation business.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. Our aviation services business finished 2013 with $10.8 billion in revenues, $97 billion in long-term service agreement backlog, and a terrific installed base of 34,000 engines and growing. Now, you've seen today that all the services leaders have the same imperatives, which is terrific because it gives us a great platform to learn from each other. What I'm going to talk about today is how we align around our aviation customer needs. And then how do we use services technology as well as analytics to bring more value to our customers and to GE? Before we start, the fundamentals for growth in aviation are strong. Traffic is growing in all regions, up 5.8%. Utilization continues to grow. And we've added 1 million enplanements over the past year. To put that in perspective, 2 out of every 3 flights that take off around the world are powered by us and our JV partners. Every 2 seconds, a plane takes off somewhere in the world powered by us. So what does that mean to a services business at aviation? It means an install base that delivers shop visits growing at 4% now through the end of the decade. So two big themes on this page I want you to take away. Number one, we're focused on our customers' 3 big pressures: maintenance cost, dispatch reliability, and fuel. We align our product and services strategy around each of these. But our analytical strategy fits with our services strategy. So, for example, we do analytics-enabled work scopes in order to deliver lower cost of technology, lower cost of ownership and maintenance. We take diagnostics and the ability to convert that to prognostics in order to improve reliability for our customers. And we're bringing 2 new capabilities to the market with flight efficiency services and performance navigation, which I'll talk about today, which save fuel. But think about it. We also have the ability to take, for example, the work scope element, not only to lower maintenance costs, but to learn how to optimize work scopes with analytics to save fuel. Technology is a big piece of our services business. If you look at it, we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of CFM. CFM went into service in 1984, powering the 737. Now, since that time, we've introduced eight upgrades that have delivered 8% fuel burn improvement and doubled the time on wing. That keeps fleets flying, which is great for a services business. Number two, analytics also gives us the ability to tailor our services offering around what customers want, depending where they are in the 25-year life cycle of an engine and an airplane, whether it's a risk transfer product, overhaul and materials product, or to help them manage asset value over time. So let's talk a bit about how Minds and Machines works at GE Aviation. For us, it's the marriage of analytics and physics. It's the ability to take millions of flight data into our analytics center in San Ramon to clean that data, sort the data, secure it, and then work with the applied engineers who understand what changes in temperatures and pressures and vibration mean to an engine, and convert that physics into action, into an ability to improve time on wing and reliability and lower their cost and ours. Now, here's a simple example of how analytics is helping us in our CSA portfolio. This is one part in an engine, an HPT shroud. And what the graph shows is the distress versus the number of flights or cycles that the engine is flying. Now, you can see what we learned is that there's two very different subpopulations of airplanes flying out there, with some engines that are seeing distress faster than others. Now, when that distress gets up to that upper right-hand corner, we have to remove the engine. What this has told us is the ability to see all those points before on the top line before it reaches the upper corner, those are opportunities to intervene. It's also predictability to us on when an engine will come on wing. And we've been able to create on-wing practices that take that top line back down to be more like the nominal environment you see in the bottom. But it also says we don't have to spend our cost or our customers if that particular component is performing more like nominal environment. Now, so far this year, we've been able to identify 120 removals saved on the GE90, which powers the 777, 40 on the CFM56, and it's allowed us to optimize the kind of tools like WaterWash that we use to help airlines save fuel. You heard this morning from Chief Pilot and Head of Flight Operations from AirAsia what we're doing to go use analytics on fuel spend. It really gets down to two big applications: flight efficiency services, which looks at everything from what you're doing with the airplane on the ground to taxi to the various phases of flight, and performance-based navigation, which looks at flight time and approach into airports. It's terrific to see this product work with our customers, and it was great to have AirAsia up here today as a partner in helping us grow this product. Thank you very much, and I'll introduce Brian Palmer from Oil and Gas.
Thank you, Kevin. Good afternoon. Oil and gas services, over $8 billion in revenue in 2013, nearly $6 billion in backlog. Both are targeted to grow at a healthy rate into 2014. This represents about 45% of the revenues in 2013 of the oil and gas portfolio. And just like you've heard from my predecessors, in growing and mining that installed base within oil and gas becomes more and more critical as we grow. And so we see good, healthy growth of our installed base led by our turbomachinery business and our subsea business with over 13,000 units. Dan talked about strategic imperatives of the services business and the real value of the service council that we have across the company. I won't go into each one of these, but I do have some examples that I want to cover. One on customer value and customer co-creation. You've seen some of our customers, those of you who are here this morning, really passionate about creating solutions together with us. You heard from the Columbia Pipelines Group. You heard from other oil and gas customers. I also want to talk about the value of software data analytics to driving productivity in our CSAs. And that becomes a very important element for us to not only gain and get the reward of the bonus by overperforming on a CSA, but also to continue to drive efficiency with the work scopes that we've signed up for. Jeff talked about earlier about the power of 1%. And I think the numbers on the oil and gas business, 1% uptime was worth $5 billion-$7 billion in the industry. And that's the real prize here for us, because customers are faced with increasing complexity of producing and refining oil. The regulations are coming at them from every angle in every one of our regions. And I'd say the majority of our customers talk to me about an impending skills gap. The fact that their technical workforce is aging and retiring, and there isn't the pipeline to fill that very experienced domain knowledge workforce. Couple that with the potential of adding data acquisition capability through sensing hardware and software to the machines that we're installing in our installed base. You get a terrific formula to drive availability, reliability, operating efficiency, and optimize production. Kevin talked a little bit about the aircraft engine model and that depth of knowledge and insight and really physical and analytic understanding of how those engines operate and how they can drive value. Well, I'd say that's what we aspire to in the oil and gas industry and our business with that installed base. So we're going to learn from his journey. And I'd say in the oil and gas industry, our customers get that too. You've heard, if you were here this morning, you heard the passion around getting this right from our oil and gas customers. But when I meet with oil and gas leaders and oil and gas companies, they know their availability numbers. They know their safety numbers. They know their reliability and uptime numbers just as well as they know their stock price or their financial performance of the business. So let me go into a few examples here of how we're driving and co-creating with customers this efficiency. And the first one we call Unified Operations. And this is a partnership with one of our very good customers, ConocoPhillips, where very simply, we're providing together with them a window for their operating team into every aspect of machine and piping condition, how the system is operating, how efficiently it's operating, what are the impending conditions or potential failures of equipment. And if you think about it, Conoco have told us that they've got a range of performance with similar assets. One part of their facility or one of their facilities, they've got a turbine or a compressor that runs at 97% reliability. They've got other parts of their operation, very similar equipment, that may be 5 points below that in availability and reliability. What Conoco have asked us to help them do is institutionalize the knowledge of the folks that are running that equipment at 97% availability and spread it across the rest of their operation. The only alternative that they've had before that is to take the crew or the engineer who's running that equipment at 97% and move them around their world and their portfolio. So we're really institutionalizing that knowledge, and it's an exciting co-creation project with Conoco. The second one is asset performance management for onshore oil production. Now, Kate touched on this a little bit, and I'll say that you would be surprised at the technology and the methodology today for onshore oil production on how it's optimized and how it's controlled. And we see fields that are currently either monitored, inspected, or controlled on a monthly basis. Equipment runs 24 hours a day, but if you're only making adjustments on a monthly basis and you're only doing predictive analytics on a monthly basis, you'll never be able to optimize the field the way it can be optimized. So we've got a customer, a pilot customer in the Middle East. We're working with them on a two-year agreement to optimize a field of assets in onshore production, and we think this will help lead to an industry standard for this. The third one, and Kate touched on this one as well, and if you were here this morning, you heard from the Columbia Pipeline Group. Operations optimization with intelligent pipeline management. And this is effectively another good customer. Columbia Pipelines came to us and said, "We'd like to optimize the operation of our pipeline based on its condition." Now, the reason they came to GE is we're the ones inspecting the condition of that pipeline. We're providing movers, whether it's compressors or pumps on that pipeline, as well as the instrumentation on the pipeline. So there's great domain knowledge on how the pipeline operates. This is the project where we're partnering with Accenture. Accenture helps them integrate into their business operating ERP system, and we stay focused on the condition of that pipeline, how the customer can operate it with impending forecast and impending load, and how they eliminate events in the pipeline industry. And then finally, just a quick example of the other variety, which I'd say is our own teams using software, hardware, sensors, data, and analytics to drive productivity in their contractual services agreement. We've got a CSA with one of the BG Group businesses in a refinery. We've signed up for a certain level of availability for that equipment. We also manage the part stream, and we manage the outage activities and duration. So using condition monitoring data and the analytics around that, how the plant operates, we can put ourselves in a bonus situation with that contractual services agreement. We can very effectively manage our part stream and our outage duration and our outage work scope. And by the way, the customer wins as well because they get increased production and higher availability. So look, these are three or four examples in the oil and gas space where we've been able to add information from the hardware, data analytics and insight combined with the domain knowledge of our teams in the oil and gas space to truly drive efficiency and value for the customer. So we're excited about these, both the pilots and the ongoing programs that we have. With that, I'll turn this over to Pete McCabe for the transportation overlook.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Look, our transportation services business is healthy. We're poised to grow pretty significantly this year, and our backlog dynamics bode well for the future years. Jeff talked earlier about our competitive position with Tier 4. those 1,000 locomotives that we want, and we really are the only competitor in the marketplace with that technology. The huge majority of those we already have service contracts for that will take us out to the next 20 years of service revenue. On the strategic side, look, we're driving the same things as the rest of the businesses out there. I think the one thing I'd point out is something we call RailConnect 360, and what may be something unique to the railroad industry. If you're going to optimize outcomes in a railroad industry, it's a systems problem. You got to look from the pit to the port. You got to look at what's going on the train, the track, the yard, the crew, and the shippers. And with RailConnect 360, we're building an integrated suite of software, something we call Railroad Operating System, built on top of Protiviti, think with ERP-like integration and ERP-like breadth that allows us to optimize across that entire railroad value chain. You know, today, the railroads are facing a seven-year high in traffic. You know, it's a great problem to have, but it brings real challenges with it. Now, how do they get more asset capacity? How do they get more resource capacity out there? And how do they deal with an ever-increasing complexity of all that traffic? And what you find is that those variables have huge multipliers with them, you know, up and down. You know, so every CEO out there is talking about velocity today, and velocity is what you think it is. It's the average speed of that train across a network. And that train behind me looks really fast. This winter, the average speed of the U.S. heavy haul rails were 19 miles an hour. So 19 miles an hour. 1 mile an hour improvement on that, or 1% improvement on that is worth $1 billion-$2 billion to that industry. The next piece that they look at is dwell time. All those cars, that's how they make money. They move that car from point A to B. 40% of the time, they're sitting idle, right? Worth $2 billion to the industry to change that one point out there. Fuel. Spend $14 billion a year on fuel, one point on that, $140 million there. And then asset utilization, how do we get more capacity? And look, these variables or these outcomes out there aren't new. The railroads have been trying to optimize these for the last 100+ years. But we think there's a new entitlement possible, and that entitlement gets fueled by software, data, and that advanced analytics. And I want to tell you, so a couple of ways that we're already doing that. First up is asset optimization. I talk about fuel. So the average locomotive burns $1 million of diesel fuel a year. To the industry, one point's worth of $140 million of savings and a big reduction in emissions, right? And fuel economy is a controllable variable, just like your car, right? The way we accelerate, change the speed we drive, change how fast we brake, and we can change the miles per hour we get out of a car. It's no different with a locomotive, except for there's a hell of a lot more variables. First off, there's 10,000 of different drivers, and that train is, you know, 2 miles long, behind me. And the way you accelerate a 2-mile-long train with all of that slack on there can make a massive difference in that fuel economy that you get. And so what we've been able to do with our Trip Optimizer solution is take what's going on with the train, the track, connected to advanced control systems and some pretty sophisticated algorithms that we built out with our global research center, and in essence, create kind of an automated cruise control that will optimize the way that train is accelerated, will minimize the way it's braked. And CSX was one of the leading adopters of that technology with us. Got about 1,500 of them out there on the road, and they're seeing significant savings, 7% fuel reductions out there. We've already got 4,000 of these out across the industry, and we look at this thing as a couple of billion-dollar marketplace that still has a lot of opportunity for penetration out there. Next up, I talk about kind of the operations optimization that we talk about. And at, you know, at the expense of kind of an oversimplifying, the North American railroad is kind of a hub-and-spoke model. So you have terminals or yards connected by long distances of mainline track. And that most of the mainline track in North America is what's called single track. And what that means is pick an 800-mile stretch of railroad, and you have an eastbound train going. Over that 800-mile stretch, he's going to have to pass 21 trains coming directly at him on the same track. And so there's a decision that needs to be made, is who has to go to the side and let the other guy through. There's dozens and dozens of variables that go into that decision today. You know, how long am I? What's my priority? Is it a UPS train coming at, you know, Black Friday on Thanksgiving? How long is my train out there? Am I late or am I on time? And today the guys that make those decisions are our dispatchers. And they have, I'll call it basic visualization tools, but they make those decisions manually. And the best of them will make very good decisions in their territory. A territory is going to be about 100 miles to 150 miles. So I have this territory, the guy next to me has the next 150 miles, and so on. And what happens is that dispatcher optimizes what's going on in his track. Get the trains out of my area. What happens is there's no way he can look at the thousands of railroads, of trains on the track at any given time. And so he makes an optimal decision for his network, which often is suboptimal for the entire network, causing, you know, huge delays in ripples in traffic. And so one of the predictivity solutions that we've built out there is something we call Movement Planner. We built it with Norfolk Southern Railroad out there. And what it does is it takes those same conditions, those same factors that dispatcher is doing, plus loads of real-time data about where the track is, what's going on, speed limits, delays, track conditions, and then again some very, very sophisticated algorithms that we built with our global research center to optimize that meet pass decision across the entire network, across what's going on with all 1,000 trains and the thousands of miles of the track. And we've had this out with Norfolk Southern for about 3 years now, and what you see on that chart is a study that we did together to kind of quantify the benefits that they'll see from this Movement Planner in their Georgia division. And, you know, 10% improvements in velocity out there, 50% reductions in what's called crew expiration. And crew expiration is, you know, crews can only drive, let's say, for 8 hours. And so a crew's out in the middle of Nebraska, they're 8 hours expire, you send a crew out to go replace them. That crew goes out, waits, no train. That their 8 hours expire, and they go home, right? So we've been able to reduce that crew expiration by about 50% out there and dramatically improve on-time deliveries, which is what, you know, in essence, the railroads get paid for or penalized for. You know, Norfolk Southern would tell you 1 mile an hour is worth $200 million to the railroad, so they're seeing significant benefits out there for this today. And look, lastly, I'd talk to you about an internal productivity project that we're driving. And this is a project that we stole shamelessly from Kevin and the aviation team. When you heard earlier about the removals on engines, it's a very similar dynamic. So most of our CSAs are fixed price, which means we get a certain amount of revenue per locomotive per day. And the burden to keep that locomotive running and all the parts associated with keeping that running comes back to us. That the single biggest cost event in the life of a locomotive is an overhaul. And the way you determine how frequently you do an overhaul is you look at historical data. You know, how long does it broken over some big, large distribution? Not all that different from how the automotive guys would tell you to change your oil every 5,000 miles, right, based on an average performance out there. What you get on top of that frequency of cost is you get unscheduled engine failures. And unscheduled engine failures are very, very expensive. So back to that single track example, when an engine fails on the line and the wheel's sealed up, that velocity goes to zero. Every train behind it goes to zero. Every train coming at it goes to zero. In our contracts today, you know, we would model that we've got about 20,000 of those overhauls to do. So the game becomes, how can I predict or prevent a road failure? How can I change the dynamics to say, let me do it based on the condition of that engine versus the average? And what we've been able to do with a sister business in GE Intelligent Platforms is take their smart signal technology and apply that to what's going on in the engines. And what I got a simple example, a real example, is today most of our competitors and frankly most of the industry will monitor that health of the engine by taking data off a sensor, comparing it to some threshold that they said, and when they pass that threshold, they send an alarm and you do something. The problem with that is there's lots of normal variation that's going on every day. And so you have to set that threshold very high so you don't get false positives on there. And because you set it so high, by the time you get alarmed, it's too late. Oftentimes, you know, you get alarm and, you know, 100 miles later, you're still out in the middle of Nebraska, and the train fails and you got a catastrophe. What we're able to do with this technology is instead of looking at a threshold, we're able to look at deviations from the norm, and we're able to look at it across multiple variables. So what you see behind me is, in the old way, we would alarm back on that red, but in the new way, what you'll see is that, hey, my temperature's operating in the normal range, but my load is very light, and the ambient temperature is very light. The physics started to change then. I alarm, and I can make that decision with more timeliness and more specificity. And what timeliness allows us to do is reduce on-road failures that we're responsible for, the costs associated with them. And then that specificity allows us to start to talk about doing those overhauls based on the condition of the engine versus an average, and we can end up doing less overhauls during the life of a contract. We have lots and lots of these opportunities out there. So look, with that, I'll turn it over to Jamie Miller, our IT leader.
Great. Hi, I'm Jamie Miller. I'm GE's CIO. And you've heard us talk a lot today about software and data and analytics and how we're using that to drive outcomes for our customers. And I'm going to talk a little bit this afternoon about how we're using those same technologies to drive results for GE. You know, we've run IT and GE for cost for a long time. And with a lot of the big technology shifts in the last few years, cloud, new technologies in data and analytics, mobility, we've really invested in a very big way to run the company differently. And we're very focused. We've got targets around how we really want to simplify our structure, you know, really reducing our manufacturing systems footprint, you know, reducing our data centers as a leverage point for really having a very focused application strategy, launching applications to power global shared services in a bigger way, and really leveraging cloud. And you hear us talk a lot about, you know, SG&A reduction in the company, and I spend a lot of time on that. But I spend as much time, if not more, really on this full stack of cost here. So really focused on services, on manufacturing, and on the sales and commercial space as well. And I'll talk through all three of those. So we think the opportunities here are really big. We spend about $63 billion in manufacturing spend in the company every year across about 400 global factories. We're focused on three big swings. The first is really laying the digital foundation, that real consolidation of our ERP footprint, leveraging data and analytics in much bigger ways. A big place we're doing this today is across sourcing. And then really using software to run our factories differently. So this is the whole notion of the integration of manufacturing and engineering design. It's really enabling our machines with sensors so that we have less unplanned downtime for ourselves and our factories, and really running our factories in a better way. You know, so in ERP is really the system, the core system in a plant that powers manufacturing from the point we take an order from a customer all the way through to when we deliver that product and collect the cash. And, you know, we've been a very acquisitive company. When we started our ERP consolidation journey 4 years ago, on an acquisition-adjusted basis, we had 564 ERPs. We've got 219 today, and in 2 years, our target is to have 34 in the company. And we're really starting to see those investments pay off. And a couple of examples, you know, GE Water is a company we built basically through acquisition, and 5 years ago, we had 22 ERPs in GE Water. Today, we're at one, and over that period of time, we've seen past dues go down, we've seen inventory turns go up, we've seen SG&A percentage go down by 10 full percentage points, all while taking out 50% of finance headcount. And in GE Healthcare today, we run about 95% of our revenue in GE Healthcare on our target ERPs, and we've seen really similar results, right? Real shifts in working capital, real shifts in on-time delivery for customers, and we've really been able to deliver both cash benefits and productivity benefits across a number of spaces in a big way for them over the past 5 years. So the teams are executing really well here. They're very, very focused. But another space, just to give you some illustration of how we're thinking about leveraging some of these technologies, you know, so oil and gas is a company where in the last 3 or 4 years we've really grown through acquisition in a big way. And we spend about $8 billion in direct material buy across the business. And while we're waiting for our ERP systems to consolidate, you know, that sourcing data, that supplier, commodity, part data, sits in about 23 different sourcing systems in all kinds of different forms and different taxonomies. And what we did in July is really ingest all of that data into a single place out at the software COE. We use machine learning for data cleansing, some other automation techniques, and in 3 weeks, we were able to turn back to our sourcing teams, you know, full transparency to that $8 billion spend across commodity, part, and supplier, and they're already out negotiating deflation and other payment term opportunities. I mean, in oil and gas, we see this as the potential for up to $400 million in cash and deflation opportunities over the next couple of years. We're working right now on energy management and power and water, and I think the thing to really think about here is with this baseline in place, when we hit the Alstom acquisition next summer, we're really going to be positioned well to drive synergies in a very big way across that space. You know, we launched 16 pilots in our plants this year across something we call Brilliant Factory. We're using FastWorks with our supply chain teams to really drive a different way to work and sprint through these pilots. In the aviation, Wilmington, North Carolina plant, we've really taken manufacturing design and we've moved that further upstream and integrated it with engineering. And we've used also automated some parts of that process. And when we've done that, what we've seen is after a few months of the pilot, up to 30% manufacturing NPI cycle time improvement. We've also virtually eliminated quality escapes that result from that part of the process, which is a really huge result. You know, down in Greenville, South Carolina, with power and water, we have put sensors on an entire manufacturing cell, and really with the goal here of understanding how can we limit unplanned downtime, and how can we use the data flow from that, coupled with our systems and our IT data, to really optimize how we can run that cell in a much much more efficient way. And again, here, after 3 months of pilot, what we've seen is a 25% increase in productivity, which really enables us to do more throughput with the same number of machines. So we're really excited about what we're seeing from the pilots. You know, obviously, all of what you see in a pilot doesn't scale equally across 400 plants because we do a lot of different things, but we're taking a step back right now and really planning how to scale this across the rest of our plants. You know, in the services space, we're seeing ways that new technology can really drive productivity differently for GE. You've heard Kevin and Pete and others talk about predictive work scope and really how we deliver that to our repair shop engineers. You know, in the bottom right is a great example of that, where we're taking, you know, this capability, you know, out of the lab, operationalizing it, scaling it in the company. We're rolled out across 4 customers in aviation right now. We'll be fully deployed by the end of by the middle of next year. And then at the top right, you see some tools we call Smart Outage, which is really bringing, you know, work scope, manuals, video collaboration with the experts, Bluetooth measurement around data input out into the hands of our field engineers as we are on the turbine deck in power and water and power gen services. So that's in full rollout this year. We're also investing in digital tools for our commercial teams. This here is a tool we call QuickQuote. This is a business that sells electrical components and switchgear for residential and commercial buildings. And it used to be to deliver a quote to our customers, we'd go out to our customer site, we'd gather up blueprints, we'd go back to the office, we'd really work with those blueprints to understand the design, work in our systems, define a quote. Today what we do is we ingest those blueprints in via PDF, and with a click of a button while we're sitting with the customer, can produce a quote in about 10 seconds, and then sit with the customer, click and drag on the design so that we're really having a much different experience with them around how we influence design, we influence buy, but something that took 3 weeks now takes 10 seconds. So it's a big, big win, and it's just the new way we think about working. These are the kinds of tools we're implementing. So we've done a lot, but we have a lot more to go, and with that, I'll turn it back to Jeff.
Thanks, Jamie. Jamie, let me grab the... I know you're a CIO, but I use the old technology and everything. So, you know, we purposely went broad and deep today to give you a sense of the reality of what's going on in the company and how important the initiative is. So let me just, I'd wrap up, I'd make 3 points. One is, this is the new battlefield. This is the new basis of competition. No matter who you invest in, if you're in the industrial space or who you cover, this is the game of the future. So this is going to be about future competitiveness, the ability to really combine analytics with physics, get more customer outcomes that are there. In a slow growth world, delivering customer outcomes is the basis on which you gain market share, cost out. So the first point I make in a big way is This is the new battleground, and we plan to lead. Number two, this is the benefit of the big GE. No one of our businesses could have done this individually. This is the benefit of scale. We built a center in the COE. We've been able to attract great talent to the company that can span all of our different businesses. There's a real advantage to being a first mover here, and so we've collected the best partners, and so we are really, I'd say, way out in front of our direct competitors. We can play at scale. We're recruiting the right people. And I think from an investor standpoint, when you think about GE, the benefits of scale and intellect spreading across businesses, I think, is always one of the key competitive advantages of the company. So that's point number two. So basis of competition, the advantage of the big GE. And the third one is that we can deliver for investors. We can make this tangible to you in terms of shareholder value, value creation. And I would say that's primarily going to come in the early days anyhow by getting a couple points more growth in our service business from an organic standpoint and being able to increase the rate at which we can drive margin enhancement in our service business. So I think this has been our most reliable stream over time. And my goal from all my counterparts that presented to you today is to make this extremely tangible in terms of how you monetize it through the service business. And so again, the way this business works, you're going to see orders first. You're going to see margins right away. The revenue follows. Our service business goes from orders into revenue. So the margins can happen right away. The orders are going to happen right away. The revenues are growing. This is going to be very tangible for our investors in terms of how we do it. We paid for it ourselves. So in other words, we have funded this through the savings we've gotten, through simplification in terms of how we're going. I would say we're about where we need to be. We'll continue to add to it as time goes on. And then I think there's hidden benefits that we're not smart enough to tell you exactly what form they're going to take today. We're going to offer Predix. We're going to be the first guy out there offering Predix. We're going to do it in settings that make it easy for our customers. I think we got a real chance at making this the operating system for the industrial internet. We're going to get a ton more data on our installed base than our competition's going to get. We can turn this into new products as ways you can gain market share as time goes on. There's just going to be a lot of knock-on benefits that we're going to be able to talk about over time. So we'll continue to give you transparency about how we're doing. But the way I'd ask investors to think about this leaving here today is increasing the earnings growth rate of our service business, which is something you all know and can follow and can measure. And that, again, when you look at our installed base, we think we've got a good foundation to do that with. And then just in the end, a more valuable portfolio, 75% industrial. Big differentiations in terms of technology, best global footprint, growth market still growing, double digits in the GE world, transformed the service business. And I think all the elements on simplification that I've talked to you about over the last 18 months or so, those are all finding a way inside the company. So we ran a little bit long. We've got time for some Q&A. I'll be the MC and can dish the questions to the lowers. Steve, let's start with you.
Thanks, Jeff. No doubt it's easy for me at least to swallow the cost savings and the productivity in your own business. The question I have longer term for you is, how do you prevent happening here what's happened in so many other businesses, not so much for GE, more broadly, where this just becomes another cost of doing business competitively and that you're not able to hold on to the price capture and the margin, basically, from this, that it's just to say this becomes a minimum expectation for customers. Maybe more of a longer-term issue, but one that at least I'm concerned about.
So, Steve, I would give you the easiest answer I can, and that is that the machines still have a ton of value that we have. In other words, once we do this, we're not going to get another competitor in aircraft engines. We're still going to have two aircraft engine competitors. You're still going to wake up and have one locomotive competitor, right? You're still going to wake up and have a handful. And so I think our value on the equipment is so high. This is not a laptop, When I hang out in Silicon Valley, I'm always amazed at the arrogance they have about the machine itself. The machines are friggin' hard, right? And in the end, that is an amazing strength that we have in terms of how this works and where it goes. So I think in the end, that's what answers. Our machines create an incredible amount of value, and that is hard to match. When you add to that analytics, our customers can eat it.
And then just one follow-up. On the break-fix side and the profitability of that, that naturally has got to come down if all this works, right? And how do you think about your ability to make up for that with increased value in the TSA side? Or is that, am I overstating that issue?
Look, I think what's going to happen in the end, Steve, is you're going to have more of these assets go through CSAs. If you look at all the Tier 4s are through CSAs. If you look at all Kevin's new engines through CSAs. And that really aligns the win-win situation with the customers. All the Hs are going to be on CSAs. And that aligns, I think, the win-win. But I come back to, you know, guys, the fundamental dynamics around the machine side, right? The aircraft engines, the gas turbines, that's what creates this incredible strength, I would say, that we have. Yeah, right there. Can't you join us?
Thanks. I think Schneider talked last week about how, you know, their kind of R&D spend as a share of software sales is about 14-15%. Is that a similar kind of ratio to GE, or do you tend to put the software spend kind of centrally and then each business unit will get its software sales? Like, how do you think about the cost of investing in software?
So, you know, Julian, what I would say is that a lot of the early days of this I've funded through the Global Research Center. So we've kind of reallocated through the Global Research Center. I still view this as being on balance, the company being at about 5% of revenue back into R&D, probably higher on the software and service on the software side, just given the nature and the dynamics. But you know, again, it'll be a good interplay between the GRC and the businesses.
And then just quickly, you know, you're offering Predix to other customers, or you know, the installed base of competitors of yours. Do you have any targets externally for the, you know, what you're looking for in terms of revenue or growth?
So, you know, we've talked about with Kate and Bill, we've talked about, you know, kind of, again, what we call predictivity-enabled solutions. That's going to be starting, you know, primarily around GE, but there's going to be some non-GE revenue in that as time goes on. I don't know, Bill, why don't you add some color? You know, we'll have, we already are working with a handful of customers and partners as we roll this out. I don't know, Bill, maybe give a few dimensions on how you might see that.
Yeah, so the, I mean, nobody knows exactly what this market's going to look like, but I think in the consumer world you can see them moving on that platform. So when we look at it, certainly we think that they're going to do something in this area. Typically, you know, and every customer is going to be there. So for us, it is, we think it's net positive, but for us to say we know exactly what it is, we don't know yet, but we look at what Gartner's looking at the whole APM market at $300 billion. I think that if you look at the platform side of that, it's probably like any of these kinds of markets, 10 to 20% is a market opportunity that might exist in the platform side. The rest is going to be the services and applications on top of that.
And I would say we would think about it in 15 being in the tens of millions of dollars of incremental revenue in 15. And then, you know, we'll, growing from there would be safe. Scott.
Thanks, Jeff. And this is interesting stuff. It's a little over my head, which most things are, but that's all right. But can you talk a little bit about how you protect the intellectual property? I mean, it's one thing to for somebody to try to copy a jet engine, and it's pretty hard for them to find anybody who'll actually buy it if they copy it. But it seems like, you know, with some of these businesses, it could be pretty easy to, you know, steal the software codes and reverse engineer into having their own, particularly in emerging markets.
So I don't know, Kevin, why don't you go through, you know, like when you work with the any of the customers there, what kind of relationships we have in the data and how secure it is, you know, given the interface with the customer?
Yeah, you know, our customer, the data is our customers. So as it comes in, our number one responsibility is to make sure we protect our data. Now, they want us to be able to convert that data by being able to clean and sort it and create applications that are good for their dispatch reliability, that are good for their fuel burn, and good for the predictability of our CSAs. But in the end, they own it. We use the algorithms to impact that one customer. And I'll tell you, as you look at the variability of aircraft, of operating environment, of how an airplane flies, there's so much variability out there. This really is a customer-by-customer exercise. It'd be very hard to take a code without the knowledge of an engineer who designed it, an engineer who lifed it, an engineer who's been watching it over its whole life out in the field, it'd be very hard to do anything valuable with a code without that expertise in engineering.
You know, what I would say, Scott, so initially I would say the data is going to be bilateral. A lot of times the data is going to be bilateral, so it's going to be, you know, control, very tightly controlled. Number two, we'll do all the classic things we do around our own security, patenting, and things like that. But I think in the end, our thesis basically is the combination between a vertical domain and horizontal software development is really tough to match, is extremely tough to match. And I would say many things have been, that has actually been demonstrated so far.
How do you, just as a follow-up, Jeff, and how do you prevent this over the years becoming just something that gets given away for free with the CSA, that the customer just demands, you know, more for the same? I mean, do you think about packaging it separately to make sure that you always get payback for it, or is there...
So Kate comes from Oracle, and the one thing, believe me, Oracle knows how to do is make you pay a la carte, you know. So, I don't know, Kate, why don't you help that?
Sure. So, basically, I think we have a number of different ways to monetize. I think there is a definite opportunity for us to leverage the CSA channel to monetize. But you notice I talked about two other very important streams of work, one being selling standalone subscriptions, and the second being making subscriptions together. And I actually think that they're making software together with our customers. And I think that third column is very important. Also, to your first question, is that, you know, how does anybody compete? I think Jeff said it well. You got your vertical and you got your horizontal. Making software is actually technically these days not that hard. Lots of people can do it. Can they do it with a design process that's you know, operational technology oriented? I don't know of any other OT app factory in the world, right? And every day that we keep designing through it, we're getting a head start and, you know, getting a longer lead. So back to the question about how we monetize, those two things, the vertical domain and the horizontal, are very, very special sauce that we're going to wrap in standalone subscriptions. Great thing about software, build once, sell many. Not like metal, right? So there's lots of opportunity to make money there. And then on the bigger sort of enterprise projects, we want to do the same thing, design once with a customer, but then we want to put it into the other column in the copy-paste category.
John.
So I'm still not entirely clear how the revenue model is going to work. So, Jeff, you said there's about $1 billion. And I think you said it's tied to the 40 apps, but then you also mentioned you think this has the potential to be 4 to 5 billion, but there's a little bit of cannibalization. And maybe that's a question also for Bill, but in the consumer internet, right, there's these thousands of apps that are written by everybody. And I guess my question is there a risk that companies, individuals, or whatever start writing apps that can configure with Predix that's now an open standard, that in turn somewhat circumvents GE's own proprietariness of tying the customer in? So in other words, you have the basics, and then they can kind of go do a lot of this on their own. Is that in any way, shape, or risk? And then what exactly is the revenue model tied to? So I'm sorry, it's a couple of thoughts. But.
Yeah, no, so I would start, you know, the way I would think about the revenue model, John, is if you look at things like advanced gas, you know, so in other words, we're just in the early days of this rolling it out. If you look at something like Advanced Gas Pass, a lot of the revenue gets delivered through existing CSAs. So these are performance programs through an existing CSA. Some of Kevin's aircraft engine stuff will be incremental pricing through an existing CSA versus what happens with AirAsia is a freestanding fuel efficiency agreement. So I would still look in the early years to say a lot of it's going to be delivered through existing service relations, existing CSAs, with maybe freestanding programs that are associated with it. Pete talked about the movement planner. That's a freestanding agreement versus a trip optimizer that might go through a CSA. So when I think about the $4 to $5 billion we talk about, I still think about probably half of that coming through a CSA and half of it being incremental revenue, something like that. And then again, guys, look, this is there's still a lot of things that are going to be out there in terms of how the market's going to form and things like that. but you know, our hypothesis is whoever has the most assets under management, whoever has the deepest domain expertise and is the early mover is going to get a ton of the revenue that comes through here. And so I'm just, you know, maybe at some point there's more competitiveness, but I think being first with the most domain expertise around the right systems is going to give us tremendous revenue. And then I would remind you guys again, I still think in the early days, you're going to see margin expansion really quickly that happens in our service business through a lot of the, you know, these are relationships we've already sold where, you know, just the stuff Kevin showed you in aviation has the chance to double our ongoing CSA productivity in that business. So you can eat it there pretty quickly. Nick.
This has been an interesting afternoon. I was just curious, a couple of things. First off, you talked about how important it was to partner, both for connectivity as well as to, you know, have consulting companies help you with the implementation. And to what extent are your partnerships exclusive? That's the first question. Secondly, access to data. I've already heard about some of your other partners that you work with to serve in the airlines industry. Some significant skirmishes with regards to whose data the airline's data actually belongs to, the airframe or you as the provider of a lot of the services in the engine. And I was curious if you could just comment, you know, a little bit about those two aspects.
So I think, you know, it's unlikely to think that you're going to be an exclusive partner with a Cisco, you know, Nick. You know, in other words, I think there's going to be first mover advantages. You're going to have maybe a technology advantage, but at the end of the day, there's going to, you know, there's going to be some relationships that are tighter than others. You know, and with Accenture, we'll pick certain verticals that will work exclusively with each other. They might pick others that they might end up competing with us in some. So there'll be a first mover advantage. I'd say there's going to be definitely be a technology advantage. Some will be exclusive, but some will be more open. And again, if you're at United and you're going to do a time on wing CSA, it's really yours and theirs data, you know. In other words, the data becomes part of the commercial agreement as it pertains to how the CSA is going to work, what kind of productivity they expect. And I would say so far, you know, what Danny showed, our ability to get access to data is actually quite high, quite high.
In the same vein, when I listened to the transportation presentation, one of the companies today in the sector that we follow is Wabtec, which makes positive train control, which is kind of the neural center of how all of the trains here in North America operate or will operate in the future when that's fully implemented. Will you partner with them to help give them, in essence, the expertise to put a lot of their data together to work with your customers?
Look, I think the positive train control is going to be one of the nodes on which information comes. And when we did the movement planner for Norfolk Southern, we did work with Wabtec on positive train control. And we do those ourselves as well on PTC. So you got to think about it as all being connected. But in the end, if you're a railroad CEO, the locomotive is the single biggest productivity generating asset you own. I don't say this to be provocative or arrogant, but if you're an airline, I'm awfully partial to the engines as being, you know, the number one productivity asset. You know, most of the information around the medical data record comes through the radiology department. If you're a utility, how the power generation, how the turbine works is actually quite integral to how the whole operation works. So you're coming in the door with the single most valuable asset any of our customers has. Same way in oil and gas.
So would you go and approach, say, Rockwell Collins or Honeywell to get, if you will, the other complementary part of...
Look, I think this is going to form in a bunch of different ways as time goes on. There's a reason why we've done this organically is because we think integrated systems in the end are going to be favored versus patchwork systems and, you know, I've done enough IT acquisitions poorly to know how tough it is, right, to do. So I think there's a reason to do it as one system. But, you know, you guys, everybody in this room is going to go to a Honeywell meeting or a Rockwell meeting and hear a different version of the industrial internet. I just think we're faster. We've just done more so far, but the notion we're all going to have to play is probably true as well, Nick. But I come back to, there's a lot of things in here that I think are provocative, that are directions we could go. I think the one way that we can put, we can say to our investors, you're going to benefit from this, that is pretty tangible and pretty, you know, don't have to wait a long time, is increasing growth rate and the orders of our service business, including which will then turn into revenue, increasing margins in our service business. And so you have the most profitable part of the mix of GE that's going to be growing faster in the future than it's done in the past. That, I think, is pretty tangible. I think that's what you saw today. I think it's pretty compelling in terms of where, you know, where we are and what you saw today. Andrew.
You're saying that software is becoming more and more important, and two questions there. A, you know, you hear about the conflict between the software guys and the mechanical engineer guys and the factory floor guys, and they seem to never be able to get along. So how do you solve the cultural issue inside GE? And the second, how does GE get the right software engineers? Where do you get the talent?
So what I would say is that it's a great question. And that, you know, as Bill said earlier, we already had more than 10,000 software engineers inside the company when we started the COE. We just didn't have the right 10,000. So I think one of the things about industrial companies is our culture has to change. You know, our capabilities have to change. And the good news is we can recruit it. You know, in other words, I think you have to be in the right place. You've got to be in Bangalore. You've got to be in California. You've got to be in the right places. But we can recruit good talent, and we can then intersperse that with the domain. So I think, Andrew, that's you're going to have a more digitized culture. You're going to have to go to new places. But we can recruit and mix those into the GE talent pool. Once you do that, I actually think the mechanical and the software flows pretty nicely.
And just a follow-up question. In terms of ability to retain engineers, does that mean that JVing with software companies is a better way than outright purchase? And what has your experience been?
I'll answer that and let Bill answer. You know, we've taken some equity stakes in Pivotal and some other software companies. I don't think any of us have an appetite to do big software acquisitions. I think there's pieces that we can acquire, right? There's maybe small platforms that we can acquire. You know, basically, Bill showed WorldTech, which was does this Achilles standard. You know, we can acquire that company if we just turn it on ourselves and make them the standard of our own cybersecurity. You pay for yourself, you know, right away, just with our own internal, with what you pay for and things like that. So, I don't know, Bill, what would you?
Yeah, I would add one other thing, which is that there's a technology shift in what the architecture is for this, and it's very fundamental. And a good example is it's not relational database. It's the Hadoop and this new Spark, and I don't mean to go through that technology, but those technologies are different. So when you start to look at the vast majority of companies, they're still based on the old architectural stack. Finding big ones that are based on the new one, they're very hard, and they're mainly consumer internet giants. That's one. Number two is there are some really good small companies, and that was the WorldTech is a great example, that come in that become tuck-ins. And the second thing is JVs give us the ability to get the horizontal technology some upside, but it's probably not something we have to own over the long haul because a lot of the horizontal technology does get commoditized. So we're staying up at the industrial higher value and specialty capability. And so I think that's the strategy we have, and it's a lot driven by the architectural needs.
Steve.
Thanks. The first question, just on the AGPs, is there a specific age of a turbine that's, you know, more attractive for the AGP? So, you know, we think about kind of those pigs through the python. You know, what year delivered, you know, should be up most likely up for these AGPs?
Yeah, I would say, you know, we've got. The AGP offering we've done to date has really been focused just on one small subset of the fleet, so it's interesting. It's we've only offered it on 7F. You know, one of the things you'll see us do here pretty quickly is we're going to expand that to the 9F and the 9E, like at the end of this year. You'll see some products come out. I think customers, you know, we're probably 50% penetrated on what our target is in the 7F, and we're going to expand that and take it to broader parts of the portfolio. And then I would say generally, there's been a lot of focus on AGP. I think technology upgrades, broadly speaking, in the portfolio, where customers will buy it at various points in the cycle, including in the mature fleet, I think you'll see us invest and develop some solutions that would sell around a lot of that.
And they still have to, I'm sorry, Steve, they still have to be done in the turnaround, right, Paul?
Yeah.
So, I mean, in some ways, Steve, they could gate it.
They're all aligned with an outage.
When you have to do an outage.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say is that when we were doing due diligence on Alstom, we kind of envisioned their version of an AGP, which would be, it would be an ASP, let's say, that would be able to get the old steam installed plant EPA ready. And so that, again, is a hardware-software upgrade. So we've got ideas on how to monetize Alstom around, you know, the same kind of approach to what Paul just talked about.
And the 125 plus to date, is that through third quarter or is that, you know, through the end of this year?
That's through the end of the third quarter.
End of the third quarter?
End of the third quarter, yep.
Okay. And then, Jeff, I'd kind of be remiss if, you know, the world looks like it's kind of melting down out there. Any kind of comments on just the global economy and what you guys are seeing?
You know, Steve, I think there is volatility, but I look, if you look back to the financial crisis, there's been moments like this, like every 7 months or things like that. You know, it's just where everybody goes, what's going on, you know? And I just think, you know, most of what you see about the world, you can read in the newspaper every day, but we're still seeing healthy order intake. You know, we're still seeing, you know, it's not that the world's perfect, but we're still seeing growth market orders that are pretty attractive. And I just think, you know, I think we're always, I still think, Steve, we're kind of in the same world recovering from the financial crisis that's got slow growth and volatility. That's kind of what we plan the company for. So a day or two, like the ones we're having today, just, you know, don't throw me off that focus. Hey, thanks. We kept you long today. We'll go one more question. I didn't want to make that, but I saw the hand go up, so it better be a good. It better be an easy one.
Desperate lunge, yeah. I've got two great questions.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
So you sounded really confident on the service margin. You said very tangible, very real. And is that because first of all, is this because you expect service margins to improve in the near term? I'm talking here 15, 16. First of all, is that correct? And secondly, is it because you're seeing materially better margins in the CSA backlog, that $180 billion backlog? You're seeing materially better margins in that backlog?
So, you know, the way, again, I talk about an initiative like this, it's on service. So, you know, we always get orders and then we get revenue. And then, but on cost, you can start that right away, right? So you basically can start the productivity instantaneously, but you have to go out and sell something before it becomes revenue. So you can see the incoming orders, and we can see margins. And I just look at these two guys' business, Paul in his old job, Kevin in this job. There's just so much more science around how we think about CSA portfolio, what the usage is, what the technology is. And I think what came from Kevin's chart is, you know, you can now profile an engine that takes off in Dubai and Shanghai and Chicago in a very different way. And we, you know, we just couldn't do that 2 years ago. So you basically have some incoming ways to think about the world that is very different than what we had in the past.
And then the $1 trillion of assets under management right now, how much, you know, is that all Predix enabled, you know, or can they be Predix?
Potentially, right? So it's not 100% of our installed base, but it's, you know, not all of our installed base is going to be able to be Predix enabled. Right, just given the age of the technology and the ability to get sensors and stuff like that on. Great day. Thanks for your attention. I know we ran long, and the team will be around for a while. For those of you that came this morning, thanks for coming this morning as well. It matters. Great.
On the other side of the street, I knew.
Thank you for your participation in today's webcast. This concludes the presentation. You may now disconnect. Good day.